Hi, this is Everett, producer of The Scalpel. Today, a very special presentation. Dr. Rose speaks live with a contact from inside Afghanistan. If you've been watching what's happening over there right now, the Taliban is sweeping through the country. Cities are falling. Kabul is in the midst of it right now. And our contact there is providing an inside view of the current situation in the country and the imminent threat and potential fall of the American embassy to the Taliban. Good people are in trouble. What you are about to hear will shock the conscience of our country. You need to listen to this.
The Scalpel with Dr. Keith Rose. Cutting down to the truth through history and experience. The Scalpel is proudly sponsored by Z-Bone's Bone Conducting Headphones. Learn more at zbones.io. Subscribe to The Scalpel wherever you listen to podcasts. Follow us on Instagram at The Scalpel Podcast, on Twitter at The Scalpel Edge, email kfr@scalpeledge.com, or the website scalpeledge.com. The next episode of The Scalpel starts now.
Welcome to The Scalpel. This is Dr. Keith Rose. We have a very unique episode today. We are coming to you live from Kabul, Afghanistan. I'm speaking with a dear friend of mine that I've worked with for almost two decades, someone who has a real heart for the country like I do, and someone that knows Afghanistan, Pakistan, and that entire region better than almost anyone alive outside of those countries. And he's there today, so Bob, not his real name, welcome.
Yes, I'm glad to be able to join you. Sorry, I can't spare too much time, but we're in the middle of a crisis here.
I understand. Go ahead and tell me about the crisis you're in and what's going on.
If you wanted to have a situation of the barbarians at the gates, that's what it feels like in Kabul. They already here, we've been receiving thousands of refugees who have been pouring into the city from the provinces around the country, which have been taken by the Taliban war parties in recent days and weeks. They are crowding out the mosques and any houses that they can find. We've seen retreating forces coming into sort of like the remaining provinces, some of them reaching back to Kabul, and there is a palpable terror around the city as to what happens next, and when the turn of Kabul comes, at a time when I should make it clear that, of course, there has not yet been fighting inside Kabul, but the terror has reached Kabul as the fighting has washed across the rest of the country. Just yesterday, I was crossing one of the passes in Kabul, just taking a route up over the TB Mountain to get from the center of the city towards the west of the city.
Towards Darlaman Road.
Yeah, and as we looked, and I'm sure you're familiar with that route.
Yes.
Heading towards the west, where I know that you have supported some of the NGOs and good work there. As we looked back down onto the main part of the city, it's really spread out in a great plain, hemmed in by mountains. And anybody who says nothing good has happened over the past 20 years really should have looked at that site, because there is a partly developed city there. If you'd looked back there 20 years ago, you would have seen ruins, and now you can see that they apartment blocks, you can see city offices, you can see business and trade centers. You have, by the standards of the region, you have a reasonably developed city.
And basically, you have wedding halls, beautiful. I mean, it was a shell of a city 20 years ago.
thrust. And as I looked back with our Afghan friends, they looked at that and said, is this going to be turned into Syria? Because that's what people are worried about. They're having the tales of the fighting which has gone on, you know, throughout the country. But I think that the intense fighting which has been going on in coming days, the kind of fighting which has seen one brother's house taken over by the Taliban while the other brother's house is taken over by government forces. Those two forces slog it out between themselves and both sets of families have to flee and find somewhere to stay. That kind of fighting might be over quickly. It might not take long, but the terror which comes in its wake is that which is really that they hear, paralyzing people now, because people talked over the past 3 years during Ambassador Khalilzad's efforts to put together some kind of peace process. They talked about this idea as to whether the Taliban have reformed. Now, I think that the ISI and some of the backers of the Taliban, they tried to sell this idea to Ambassador Khalilzad that we're dealing with a reformed Taliban now. But what has actually played out in recent weeks is it turned out it's not that they haven't reformed, they've got worse. This time, as the Taliban tries to grab power, not only do they still have their old allies, Al-Qaeda and the most dangerous militant groups of the world, still working with them, they also have a far more developed intelligence service, which is well organized, which has its links back to the ISI, of course, but mainly is working on its own account. And as the Taliban army is sweeping across the country and taking over areas and particular towns that for 20 years enjoyed some kind of freedom, enjoyed relations with the world, appreciated the assistance that they got from the United States and other countries, the Taliban intelligence are turning up with a list. They send the men out with their masks and their dark glassed vehicles. They're banging down doors, they're picking people up and they're carrying them away and they're killing them. And that is the fate which awaits anybody who has been associated with the international effort to support Afghans in realizing their freedoms and building their countries in the past 20 years. Everybody knows that if the Taliban pull off what they're trying to do at the moment, a toppling of Kabul and the country faster than Saigon fell, and then that is the fate that awaits everybody who worked with the United States and its allies. I worry that one of the reasons that the US has been slow to come up with a response to this growing crisis, along with its allies, is that they have not yet realized how bad this will look in 3 months, in 3 years, and in 30 years. It's looking very bad already, and it's going to get worse, and it will have real consequences for the rest of the world, including this region, of course Afghanistan, but also Europe and the United States. The collapse, unnecessary collapse of Afghanistan will come back to bite us really hard.
I agree. And the young lady who hadn't worked with the Americans but had just worked to support women's rights that was taken off the bus the other day and executed for nothing.
Shafika,
yes.
She was really when I saw the Shafika's picture of her lying in the road, blood seeping into the asphalt, wrapped with her, most of what she wore was, the traditional moderate, all in enveloping shawl, but actually below you could see she was wearing jeans. I thought that, this picture should be actually imprinted in all of our minds, because in a sense she was, she was somebody who symbolized this idea that, there were freedoms. She worked in the civil society. I think she helped with the Ministry of Women's Affairs.
Women's Affairs, right.
and that the and she's the kind of woman who would typically be invited to the provincial headquarters to sit in any provincial meetings and any consultation about, you know, the women's perspective on development. Because this was one good development over the past 20 years was that, you know, with due respect for Afghan customs, at least people took the trouble to ask what women wanted and what their perspective on developments was. And now somebody can be discovered by Afghan intelligence, by Afghan Taliban intelligence, dragged off a bus, and summarily executed with no consequences.
That's the problem.
Small example of the consequences.
Right. There's no consequences. When Ambassador Khalilzad have negotiated with the Taliban, have they followed? Have we held them from our side to any conditions? And what is the? I know you are in touch with the pulse of what's going on there. What do the Taliban say about the negotiations?
I think the practical example of what's happened on these supposed conditions is that the Al-Qaeda, remember that name? Al-Qaeda organization is now part of the general mobilization by the Afghan Taliban. There may not be, as a percentage, there may not be huge numbers of them, but they have a significant and visible role in sitting with their own, sort of halfway houses, staging posts, where they receive militants coming across the border from Pakistan, including both foreign nationals and also Pakistani nationals who are they affiliated with regional jihadi organizations who over the years have been supported by the ISI. They go to the staging posts, run in a house controlled by Al-Qaeda. They get their orientation. They get assigned to Taliban units and they're sent off onto the front line. And for some of the most notorious extremist groups who've been involved in carrying out summary executions and massacres against the Shias in Western Pakistan, they are being sent to the front line fighting against Afghanistan's Shia Hazaras. Now, if anybody thinks that ultimately this does not morph into a threat against the United States, then they don't know the history of Islamic terrorism. It was told to us that the Taliban had given guarantees that they would prevent the Al-Qaeda and other terrorist organizations using Afghan soil against U.S. interests. This is the remobilization of Al-Qaeda militants who are putting themselves in a position to enjoy in the spoils of victory. If this is what the Taliban get, this will rapidly morph into a direct threat against U.S. interests. So this is just a small example of the flagrant violation of the conditions which the Taliban had in their agreement with the United States. But in reality, what happened was Ambassador Khalilzad told us all the United States had a conditional agreement with the Afghan Taliban, according to which, of course, as part of the UN, the US part of it, the US would withdraw its troops. The Taliban were supposed to cooperate with the United States in moving towards a ceasefire and a political agreement. For not one moment did the Taliban show seriousness with regards to a political settlement and achieving a ceasefire. And yet the United States, unfortunately, disregarded the Taliban's flagrant violation of these conditions, went ahead anyway with its withdrawal of its troops, and basically never seriously paid attention to the kind of preparation which would have been required inside Afghanistan for the period after the withdrawal of troops. And for me, that's really the main issue, and I think that's the main thing that Afghans are grappling with. Many Afghans were absolutely happy with the idea that the U.S. troop presence should be temporary. They're happy with the idea that the troops should leave. Afghans know how to fight. They're happy to defend their homeland. But the thing is that most of the preparations which were supposedly put in place were on paper. They weren't real. They were undermined by many of the other things which were happening. But the United States spent 2.5 years working with the Taliban instead of working with the Afghan government and working with the popular forces who had the capacity to resist the Taliban. Instead of organizing and strengthening those forces, the United States, and to some extent the Afghan government and its actions, they weakened the forces that were required to resist the Taliban. And now we're at this stage where the barbarians are at the gate. Still, some of the key areas of Afghanistan are in the control of the internationally recognized government. At this late hour, if there is a serious turnaround and change in approach by both the United States and the Afghan government, through which the Afghan security forces and also the popular forces who are determined to resist the imposition of this medieval rule and externally backed tribal war party, if those forces get the reassurance that, yes, we are serious about supporting you, protecting your hard-won freedoms, then I think morale will be restored. And there is a way out of this crisis.
Tell me about that. Tell me about that way out. Right. What does that look like in bullet points? What does that look like? Because you and I have discussed this. There is still a chance to turn this around. How would that happen?
Absolutely. There has to be a commitment that the resources which are required by those forces who even now want to stand up to the Taliban are actually going to get to them. I sat yesterday with one of the leaders who is a prime leader of one of the largest stretches of territory and population which is still holding out against the Taliban, where the popular militias are defending the front lines against the Taliban. They have access to no military supplies. It's all very well to say that we've spent billions of dollars in supporting the Afghan government, but the people on the front line have not received those supplies. Now, that is partly a question of getting, it's a basic question of getting the resources, the resources to where they are required. If there's reassurance that the United States is going to be serious about continuing its support and ensuring it gets to the right people, and from the Afghan government that they make the changes like today or tomorrow, that they have to get rid of the people who have been frankly diverting some of the resources and failing to support the true resistance. If they make that change and the U.S. Delivers the support, the will of the Afghan nation is still to avoid domination by this tribal war party, which is now banging on the gates. I'm going to have to be moving on here. It is a crisis situation. I'm responsible for looking after the security of many people who are in mortal peril today. I'm sure that, I mean, Dr. Keith, you understand the situation as well as I am. I'm sure that you will be able to elaborate on some of the things which...
I will, brother. Real quick, on the embassy, what's the threat there so that people know that this is important to take care of?
Whatever bland reassurances Taliban political representatives might give in Qatar, there are elements in the Taliban armed forces operating under the Taliban flag who see this whole exercise as an opportunity to demonstrate that they have defeated and humiliated the United States, and they are determined to make it look as bad as Saigon or even worse. They are well aware that things have been conducted in such a way over the past couple of years that there have been next to no US casualties. There are absolutely people in the Taliban army who would like to do maximum damage to US civilians or military. Therefore, I would take the threats to the embassy and US personnel remaining in Afghanistan extremely seriously.
Are there sleeper cells inside of Kabul right now, and are there rockets inside of Kabul?
I can tell you that as I move around Kabul, although ostensibly it is a normal looking city, most normal activities are continuing, I can tell you I have the most strict possible security arrangements, because I know at every stage along the way there is a risk of running into one of these Taliban sleeper cells. So far, the simplest activity they've been involved in is attaching magnetic mines to people's vehicles, which then blow up, killing the occupants. However, as they've gained in confidence, with the approach of their main army, the risk is they can start a street battle, that they can try and take people captive, or indeed they can try to start some kind of uprising inside the city, grab parts of the city. Now, I still believe that the situation can be reversed if there's urgent and profound action taken. However, I certainly would urge the U.S. authorities to take whatever actions they can to protect the security of their remaining personnel. And I should say, and I hope at least there are some positive consequences for Afghans as well from the measures which the U.S. responsibly puts in place to protect its embassy and personnel.
Thank you, brother. Okay. Please be safe, and I'll be talking soon. Let me know if you need anything.
Thank you.
All right. Roger. Bye-bye. That was sobering. That was sobering because a place that I worked at for almost 15 years and people that I've developed deep friendships with are in extremis. Not only there, but there's a hospital there that I believe they're on their 8th fellowship class of OB-GYN doctors, female doctors that are providing maternal fetal medicine for Afghans. They're on their 8th family medicine residency class, family doctors that are going out through the countryside. This is a country with good people that just want to live and be free. And everything that's happening right now is preventable. We were limited on our comm window, our communications window, because my friend has to move every 20 minutes to keep him and the men he's working with safe so that they can continue to push for peace in Afghanistan. What he didn't have time to tell you, but I can tell you, is there is a way forward. He mentioned it, but even more so, because a lot of the, quote, mid-level Taliban commanders don't want to work with the main Taliban structure. They don't like the centralized Taliban government coming out of Quetta. But they have no alternative right now because they're not giving any impetus of what's going on. They have a gentleman, Ambassador Khalilzad, who has made grand promises. And the only side that has kept those promises is the U.S., and the Taliban have laughed. And the potential for a Saigon-type disaster is imminent. I want you to welcome to the show a dear brother of mine, Baba Tim Lynch. Baba and I have spent over a decade in Afghanistan together, working all regions, and he's a former Marine major. And it's good to have you on the show, brother. I know you were listening to our dear friend. I called him Bob. We'll just call him Willie. I heard you. I know you listened to what Willie was saying. And what are your thoughts?
Very depressing. It's very depressing. First off, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. And when you hear reports, the initial reports from a far battlefield, you can almost universally assume they're exaggerated. But I've been hearing exactly what Willie's been hearing. I've been hearing from Afghanistan.
What he's seen. Yeah.
Zaranj and Jalalabad. And I didn't want to believe it because it doesn't make sense for the Taliban to be inciting this type of hostility amongst their fellow countrymen. But there you have it. So Afghanistan has traded a puppet government supported by infidels for another puppet government supported by Pakistan. And that's exactly how I think most Afghanistans are going to view the Taliban.
Well, that and Iran. You have suitcases of cash coming in from both sides. But what Willie said, and I can elaborate on this, and I'll just give you guys some inside baseball, because currently right now, my heart is with my friends in Afghanistan, is that there are a lot of foreign fighters there. The reason I know that is because we've passed off video of these foreign fighters for over the past 2.5 years to the Pentagon. And they've done nothing. We were telling them the ineffectiveness of Ambassador Khalilzad for the past 2.5+ years, and no one has done anything. There is a peace plan that could be put forward if you had someone in a position of authority that actually cared. Now, this peace plan doesn't require a large level of troops. It doesn't require big forward operating bases that put off big government contracts. It just requires understanding the people in the environment and supporting those directly that can ensure peace in that region. Because right now we're creating a jihadi Disneyland.
Yeah. Well, it's going to attract foreign fighters, because if you were an Islamic jihadist who wanted to make a mark and establish a reputation, where else would you go right now? You go where the fighting's good, where everybody's winning, right?
That's correct. And you, Tim, your past job, you were originally the RSO, the regional security officer for the embassy. What are the threats to the embassy right now?
Well, real quick, I was the first head of the security force. The RSO was
Okay, you're right. You're not a state guy.
Right. I reported to the RSO. I was the project manager for the first embassy security force. And right now, my feeling is the threat to the Americans in the embassy doesn't have to be the Taliban. It could be a riot. And I'm afraid that I wouldn't blame the Afghans for rioting, given some of the shenanigans we've been pulling. Khalilzad was responsible for how things were developed in 2002. Khalilzad's the one that cut out the Taliban tribes from the initial Jirga in 2002, when Karzai said they could come. We created this in no small part because we've had an Afghan-American ambassador / presidential envoy who appears to be on his own program, which I think our friend Bob could wax eloquent about.
Willie could wax. Well, what he could tell you is that Khalilzad has a son, and his son doesn't go by the last name Khalilzad. He takes his mother's name. And I've looked up his son, and his son, about the time Khalilzad took over the peace talks, his son got a job with Cerebras Capital to develop the Asian frontier business model, or whatever. You can look it up on their website, but basically to develop projects over in that region, financial projects. And ironically enough, speaking with Willie the other day, he told me that the Taliban have met with, and this is open source now, it's been reported in the Indian news, they have met with the TAPI pipeline, the Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India pipeline officials. They had already met with them, and they're working out a deal for a pipeline. And I don't know. I guess if you're in charge of that peace process and you're giving the Taliban everything they want and you're giving the U.S. nothing it wants, and then the Taliban are already meeting. You see, the Taliban are meeting with pipeline officials to help facilitate a pipeline. I don't know. It just doesn't smell right to me.
This is so unfortunate, because there was a time, I'm in the middle of reading the 3-book trilogy on Theodore Roosevelt, and there was a time when public officials would lose money to do their service because, for instance, if they were going to be the Secretary of the Treasury, they could no longer have bonds or in railroads and keep stock. All that stuff had to go. They would lose money to serve on principle. Unfortunately, these days, it's so easy to look at somebody like Ambassador Khalilzad, follow his trajectory from in Afghanistan, then sent by Bush frantically to Iraq. Then he's in the private industry where he does stuff like I'm sure his son's involved with. Then he comes back in to try to save things at the end. And it's disturbing because it's way too easy to see that he's motivated by other things, or potentially when you want to believe he's trying to do what's best for the American people. It's hard to look at those kind of business entanglements and say, oh, that's irrelevant to his overall performance. And it's very disturbing.
That's disturbing that, you know, is it normal? You and I spent a ton of time in Afghanistan. We lived there. Is it normal for an Afghan son to take his mother's name?
Oh, if his dad is not held in high esteem, it is.
Well, this dad is pretty held in pretty high esteem. Would it make sense that his son would take another name and then get hired by Cerebras Capital? I mean, why not just use the name Khalilzad?
Well, I think we both know why. And that's just, it's one of these unfortunate things But the way that we have treated Afghanistan and the personalities involved, most of whom we know very well personally, it's hard. You can't separate their personal interests from their professional responsibilities. There's no defining line there. And that is not the way. That's not a way a country who's serious about what it's trying to accomplish in the world. That's not how it acts. That's not the mark of a serious country or a serious organization when I'm referring to the Department of State.
Right. And when Willie and I were talking last night late, and in full disclosure, I was up most of the night talking with my friends in Afghanistan. There are some physicians there that are just paralyzed with fear. They're concerned for their families, for their lives. And my concern is for them. It's also concern for the Americans that are stuck in the embassy, because like you mentioned, I remember the riots in 2006. If they get a flash mob, it could shut down the embassy. And if the Taliban then shoot a bunch of rockets into the airport, you're not going to have any air assets coming in, because they're not going to be able to fire at the rockets because they're in the city centers. And so what could happen?
The Taliban, if they're going to try to hurt us on the way out the door, they're going to do it with 15,000, 20,000 civilians in front of them. Because in 2006, a riot was precipitated by a U.S. Army convoy that got into a vehicle fatality accident on the northern parts of the city. It just come down off the Somali plains, and they lost their brakes and ran into a bunch of civilian carts, killed some people.
I remember.
As Afghan civilians are wont to do, about 2,000 or 3,000 stopped what they're doing and crowded around to see what was up, which freaked out the army guys. And on live TV, on Tello TV, we're watching this. They start raking the crowd with a 50 cal. Oh my God, they were knocking people over like bowling pins. And we were watching this, and I was working for the JICA, the Japanese people at the time. And I said, and we were frantically trying to get the Japanese to cover before the crowd boiled up and came to our part of the city. And they did. They shot one of our security guards in the leg, the poor albino kid. He's always bitching about them targeting because he's albino. Yeah, it was terrifying. I mean, when that crowd rolled past us, it was terrifying. And that's exactly what.
Well, those mobs would. I mean, we had this when we were working down in Kandahar, you and I. We would slip into the city, and our big concern wasn't the Taliban as much as it's just a flash mob. You know, that just decided that, and those mobs will tear you limb from limb just by the sheer, I mean, it, I, you know, think of Antifa on steroids.
And they got over the Quran burning. And Mazar Sharif was a pretty chill place. I mean, I didn't even carry a rifle up there ever. I mean, it was very chill, but they, in an instant, got upset about some kind of Quran burning and went and got a hold of the UN folks there and they went medieval on them. It's quite distressing to see.
Right. And so what we have right now is we have a setup for disaster. And here's the other problem that I see, and I'd like to get your take on it. I don't believe the Taliban, and I know their benefactors are the ISI in Iran, depending on the Iranians are supporting Shia one side and Taliban are supported by ISI, but there's a little mixture in there because the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Right now, I don't believe either group respects the United States of America and this administration. I believe that they could blow that embassy, burn it to the ground, and they're not afraid of any reprisals. And that's not a good position to be in.
No, it's not. And we find ourselves, because I've been doing a lot of writing of official, P2 visas. I worked in Zaranj for a year, as you remember, did all the irrigation in Nimroz.
Tell everyone where Zaranj is so they understand. It's close to Iran.
Portion of the city, of the country, excuse me, Nimroz province is in the south. If Nimroz province is a desert with a belt of greenery and habitation up in the northern part.
I remember.
And then you go down to the southern part and it's all Baluch people. They're, Zaranj, the capital city, is on the border. And the Marine Corps, who was responsible for it, couldn't work down there because it was on the border with Iran. So I went with my USAID money and did all their irrigation systems. It took a couple of years. So I know the governor. I know the area very, very well. The governor who surrendered the city, the first city to fall, is a military academy graduate. His name is Barahawi.
He's a smart guy.
Well, very smart, very tough. Bear Howie is a peoples. They're a subset of the Baluch.
Right.
This weird Indo-Turkic language sort of sound like Pasha'i. Very strange.
I remember. I couldn't understand a thing they said.
Yeah. Oh, no. They speak Brahui. It's different than Baluch, which is different than anyway. So when he pulled out, my understanding from people there was he was going to the desert because he didn't want to see the city destroyed and fighting and daring the Taliban to come after him because he's not going to do anything to surrender to Taliban. He never has, never will. But that left. And at the exact same time, the Biden administration releases this P-1, P-2 visa, which means guys who were not interpreters but worked with us can now come. And my guys, I'm writing them letters, but I'm telling them, dude, go across the border to Iran. How the hell are you going to get to Kabul? And by the time you get to Kabul, I don't think we're going to be there. But they don't want to go to Iran.
Yeah, I think they're going to have to lock the embassy down just because they don't know if any sleeper cells. If they get the wrong person in the embassy, you remember the two people that were shot inside the embassy one time.
Yeah, well, that was next door.
Two girls. Right.
The two colonels working on Afghan presidential corruption, as I recall, when Taliban mysteriously infiltrated into the they were in a talk. Yeah, they were inside of a talk. They were in a skiff. They were inside of a skiff, which for the audience is like
it's a secure compartment information facility.
Inside a skiff, shot in the back of the head, allegedly by some guy who was already dead, but I'm sure by the time his name was released. And that is the problem with the current Afghan government, with stuff like this, the shenanigans that we shouldn't have tolerated.
And the Afghans are patient. And it's really not the Afghans. It's these sleepers inside there. You and I dealt with a lot of sleeper cells when we were there. But that was back when you could deal with them effectively.
Yeah, but as we pull stunts like abandoning Bagram and telling the Taliban in Qatar we're leaving, but not telling the Afghans outside the gate, and I got a feeling we're going to try to slip out of Kabul on the down low, but actually it's too late for that. That has all the potential. That has 1,000 ways to go pear-shaped and maybe 2 ways it can go acceptably.
And my understanding is the current president of the United States is on vacation. And when he went on vacation, the commander-in-chief, when the president does that, it's precedent that they will announce when the president's coming back. The president is gone from X time to Y time. That's tradition. Now, we have President Biden leaving, but there's no mention of when he's coming back. So who's in charge?
That could potentially be an advantage. You know, when Teddy Roosevelt was the Undersecretary of the Navy, they were, this is before the Maine blew up, but it was obvious we had problems with Spain and the Philippines and Cuba. And so when the Secretary of the Navy went on vacation, who was a former mayor or governor of New Jersey and an old guy, and he was going to be out on his farm and nobody was going to get to him. And Roosevelt saying, don't worry, everything will be fine. I'll take care of everything. Before that guy's carriage was outside D.C., Roosevelt was sending orders to the entire Navy to muster in different various places and call up and stand by for orders. And he kept on writing to the Secretary of Navy saying, yeah, nothing's going on. Everything's fine. Don't worry about it. We're good here in D.C. Nothing's happening. Meanwhile, he's spent the entire budget calling up the fleet and buying extra ammo. So you'd like to think you had guys in D.C. would do the same thing now, but it's inconceivable.
Yeah, he was buying up extra ammo. You know how the guys that are defending Kabul, speaking of Willie, how they're defending Kabul? The women are selling their jewelry to get money to give to the men to fight. There are female teachers that are showing up and volunteering to fight because they said, look, if the Taliban come here, there'll be no teaching. I'll be selling potatoes. So I want to fight. And no one understands this. And the atrocities that are happening, and I'm going to post this on our social sites, a picture of that young girl that was executed. It's graphic, but it's also heart-wrenching. It shows that someone who wanted nothing more than to help women, she was targeted by Taliban intelligence. They knew she was taking a bus. They stopped the bus. They just pulled her off, and they executed her.
Yeah, just like that Pakistani girl.
Correct. And what we're seeing right now is there are a lot of people of color and extremists, and I just want to know, do their lives matter? Because we don't need the troops there to settle this out.
there are people there that can do the right thing if they get the right support. And I won't go into detail on this show about that, but if anyone from the government actually wants to know that, they know how to get in touch with me.
No, the thing is that just like our friend Bob described, which is exactly what I heard, is the Taliban can get resupply. They can get weapons and ammo. They can pay their fighters. They can do all, they can give them food. They do all these things where the Afghan security forces haven't been paid in forever. They're not getting any resupply of ammunition or equipment. It is rather discouraging. And
it's almost like the Kurds.
You know, you could put a guy down in the Sharbojak district with Governor Brahui. It'd only take a couple guys that can dial up air support.
Yeah, you just need TAC air. Yeah, you just need tactical air and then support the guys, and you could turn this around.
Small arms ammunition. It doesn't take a lot. It's not hard to figure out, but it's a difficult thing to do when you're so modern and advanced that you absolutely believe that the most important thing in the world is to get female SEALs because there's not enough of them, and it's an equity issue.
Yeah.
That's what the leadership's focused on now. They can't even fight a fire on the docks. They let their most expensive amphib burn to the waterline. And my understanding is that the many admirals in D.C. were calling down there saying, don't risk the lives of the sailors fighting that fire. Let the professionals handle it. Let the fire department do it. Unbelievable.
Yeah,
and
well.
If those reports prove out to be true, and I'm pretty certain they are, our military is in disgrace. I mean, they can't.
Well, if ships. Well, and I hope that's not a pretense to that's what's happening right now in our nation, because what Bob is talking about is the military had an amphibious craft on fire, and basically it just burned in front of their eyes, kind of like Afghanistan is on fire and burning in front of their eyes. And I just pray we don't end up with a bad Saigon-esque or worse, because it's out there. Or worse.
Yeah, and that result was a brand new LHD. It has a flight deck. It has a well deck. It's massive. They're bigger than the old World War II fleet carriers. Immensely capable, complex ships. Burnt now, being towed away for junk. $1 billion down the drain, because we didn't want to risk firefighters.
Yeah. Well.
But we have the diversity. But the diversity, that's all good to go.
Yeah.
I guess that's what's important.
Well, brother, I appreciate you coming on the program today. I would ask that you would pray for the good people in Afghanistan, because there are some good people there. Pray for my friend Willie, Bob, whatever you want to call him, who's out there trying to help for nothing other than he believes in peace.
We've got friends that we both know in Jalalabad, and I've got them coming from Zaranj that are on their way, desperately trying to make it to the embassy right now. And
I have a feeling that the embassy is going to be shut down. Yeah. Yeah. We told them to.
Very worried.
Yeah. Well, brother, thanks for spending some time with me today. I know you're on All Marine Radio a lot. You have a blog, Free Range International, and I know you don't do it all the time, but I would encourage everyone to Google Free Range International. If you want to really have a behind-the-scenes look at what's going on over there and just some brilliant writing, check out my brother Baba Tim Lynch's blog, Free Range International, and eventually he'll finish his book that he's working on. You know, by the time, you know, I have grandchildren, but it'll get there.
I appreciate the brilliant writing, questionable on the punctuation and editing. But if you'll notice, back in 2009, I said on that blog, there's only one way this is going to end. There's only one way it can end, and that way is now coming.
I believe you and I were enjoying adult beverage at a safe house outside of Jabad in Bagrami, and you looked at me and you said, bro, if they keep going the way they're going, they're going to be evacuating troops off the rooftops just like they did in Saigon. Hey, thanks for spending some time with me today, buddy. I appreciate it. All right. Everyone, thank you so much for this unique episode of The Scalpel. Share it with your friends. Let people know what's going on. We have a humanitarian crisis. Pray for these people. Pray for our nation. It's so important if we're going to keep freedom rolling.
Head high, protest line. Freedom scribbled on your sign. Headline, New York Times. Standing on the edge of a revolution. Hey, hey.
with the NSA. And God, we trust, or the CIA. Standing on the edge of a revolution.
With Dr. Keith Rose.
The Scalpel is proudly sponsored by Z-Bones Bone Conducting Headphones. Learn more at zbones.io. Give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts and subscribe to The Scalpel wherever you listen to podcasts. Follow us on Instagram at The Scalpel Podcast, on Twitter at The Scalpel Edge, email kfr@scalpeledge.com, or the website scalpeledge.com.